Welcome to the Zero Input Agriculture Podcast. Today I am talking to, I would consider a friend, Sam Bonney. We'll talk about how we've come to know each other towards the end of the episode, but get us started, Sam. Tell us a bit about your background and the path that led you to crop breeding and low input agriculture and all of the good things.
Okay, happy to be here. Yeah, my name's Sam Bonney. I am an orchardist with a group called Breadtree Farms. So we are planting chestnut orchards in upstate New York, kind of on the border of Vermont. And yeah, I'm a first generation farmer. I've only been at it for 5-ish years. And it's kind of hard to trace exactly how I ended up here. But I was just a suburban kid that was a little too curious and asked too many questions. And yeah, if you ask enough questions about the way the world works and about the way that the world is dysfunctional, you end up finding your way to land and the way that people interact with the land and ultimately agriculture. Yeah, at some point I did go to college to study product design, and I was very interested in trying to do like sustainable design. And I just got very disillusioned with that program. Didn't feel like I was learning what I needed to learn in order to actually pursue my goals. And I was very interested in materials. I was interested in woodworking. That got me into trees. One thing led to another. At some point, I read J. Russell Smith's Tree Crops and yada yada, all the other like permaculture books and all of those things, some of which, if I were to read today, I might cringe at, but it all kind of led me in this direction. I ended up jumping into it pretty intensely and like went and worked at a really big apple orchard for a while and was like really trying to figure out how to make like actual scaled up food systems change, and was just like struggling with that for a while. Worked at a tree nursery. Yeah, did a whole bunch of things. And I ended up with this really awesome group, Breadtree, that I'm with now. And that's been really wonderful.
The material that you learned when you were doing product development, like way back when, has that popped up and been useful in ways that you never would have expected in this kind of new trajectory that you're on?
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of like this vague idea of like design thinking and kind of thinking in systems and stuff. And I guess I still sort of approach things that way. And, you know, like rather than just like when it comes to crop breeding, like rather than just like wanting to select a plant because it is appealing to you, like you start to think about how it fits into larger systems of cultivation and, you know, harvest systems and like what your weed control looks like and this and that. So it's like a little bit more of a networked way of thinking. But yeah, honestly, most of what I learned in school, I've completely forgotten, which I think is a good thing.
So what's your local growing environment like from people who might be from other parts of the world?
Mm-hmm. So I am in kind of the Taconic foothills here in upstate New York. So it's like rolling kind of small mountains or large hills, and then this whole area has been shaped by glaciers. So the soils are generally like gravelly, glacial till, acidic. This place was chosen for Breadtree as a project because my coworker Russell, he developed a program called BRASA, which stands for Bioregional Agroforestry Suitability Analysis, I believe, which is basically just this GIS program that, you know, you can punch in some sort of like whatever your crop is, your desired crop, and it kind of matches that to certain soils and locations. And so this whole area that I'm in is just highly suitable for chestnuts. It's acidic, well-drained soils.
Is that program publicly available? Like, is it online for anyone to play around with?
I believe it's been adapted. It was done through a group called Terragenesis that Russell used to work with. And I believe it's been adapted to work with another software that a business called Propagate has developed. And yeah, I mean, there's other variations of that. Lots of people are doing that kind of thing now. But yeah, anyway, it's great chestnut soil here in general. The American chestnut grew all over here back in the day. But broader speaking, we're in New England, or kind of New England Northeast region. And so it's pretty high rainfall, a lot of snow in the winter, humid summers, kind of a continental climate. Yeah.
So tell me about your broad priorities in crop breeding. Like that's the kind of where I like to start before we get into specific crops. Like what do you value when you're doing crop breeding?
Well, the one book that really stuck with me of all the stuff that I've inhaled over the years is called Return to Resistance by Raoul Robinson.
Oh, I love that book.
And yeah, I only have ever been able to find a PDF online, but I've read it cover to cover multiple times. And I think I found that through Joseph Lofthouse recommending it in his book. But that book is kind of delineating this way of crop breeding that's kind of more focused on populations rather than trying to develop like individual cultivars via pedigree breeding. And yeah, that just really stuck with me. And so like, I think probably the easiest to understand example of this would just be like open pollinated maize and landrace maize. And, you know, that's a crop that is outcrossing and suffers from inbreeding depression below a pretty high population size. And so you have to work with populations in order to breed maize and to just like continue to grow maize without it declining in vigor. And the result of that is that you end up with, you know, landrace maize in Mexico is just so diverse, even within a single population that one farmer is growing. And so you can have these populations that are selected to be stable for certain desirable traits, but then everything else, there's some variability and there's room to adapt to new things that come down the pipeline. And the other thing that Raoul Robinson talks about in his book is horizontal versus vertical disease resistance, where vertical disease resistance is like generally simple based on one gene or a very few genes. And it prevents infection, but it kind of acts like a lock and key thing. So as soon as a pathogen evolves that key to get in, it's in, and it can wreak havoc on the crop. Whereas horizontal disease resistance is usually more complex. It's based on many more genes that are working together in kind of hard to understand ways. And it often allows for infection, but you end up with this situation where the crop and the pathogen are kind of coexisting in this like tenuous relationship. And that's really hard to breed for with pedigrees and, you know, trying to get that one clonally propagated plant or inbreeding plant that reproduces those qualities. So yeah, the population approach is kind of the way to go to get that horizontal or like durable disease resistance.
I'm guessing that applies especially to breeding tree crops, given that the generations turn over relatively slowly, that you can't just take some new simple resistance gene and suddenly grow it everywhere. And then when it breaks, you just replace it with something, you know, a new simple resistance gene.
Yeah, exactly. And the funny thing is, in his book, Return to Resistance, Raoul Robinson says that he has like a list of crops that it's like hard to do population breeding with, and it's long-lived perennials. He says like it's hard to do this with grapes and it's hard to do it with apples, which is funny to me because it is hard to do because there's long generation times and you need a lot of space to do it. But I, like you said, if you have these long-lived plants and then the pathogen gets around that simple vertical disease resistance, you're screwed. All the work that you've invested goes away. So even though it's hard to work with these, to do population breeding with these long-lived plants, I kind of think it's the only way to do it. And currently, pretty much every single tree crop industry is based on clonally propagated plants with limited genetic diversity, and most breeding programs that are breeding for disease resistance are selecting for those kind of single genes because it's just easier. Like, you can do it in fewer generations, but it's not durable.
I have a general question. Do you think that tree crop cultivation relies on grafted clones so much because of issues around harvestability and marketability, that they want a crop where they can get the pickers or the machines in like one or two times and it's all picked? Whereas if you have a more diverse population, you tend to get a wide range of harvest times.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our chestnut plantings are seedlings, basically, just because, I mean, now we're finding all these other benefits of planting seedlings, but Chinese chestnuts, which is primarily what we plant at Bread Tree, they just don't graft well. There's grafting compatibility. And so oftentimes your trees will just die at 10 or 15 years old. But yeah, like you're saying, you run into problems where you're kind of running around at harvest time. You don't know when all the trees are going to be ripe. So you kind of have to sweep the whole orchard like every couple of days. And yeah, that is definitely not in line with the way that commodity agriculture works. It's much easier to just to have that predictability. That said, I don't think it's impossible to move populations in more kind of predictable directions in terms of like harvest dates and other important traits. You know, when it comes to annual crops, open pollinated populations can be selected to have like a narrower ripening window.
Yeah.
People are still using hybrid seed to get that same uniformity that you might get with cloning, but it's, you know, when it, like, for instance, apple trees, I've read a paper that says that the harvest, this is really obvious, but the harvest date of apple trees is highly heritable. So if you cross two trees, its progeny are going to show harvest dates that are on a bell curve. And most of the progeny are going to have harvest dates in between the two parents.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's no reason you couldn't like select populations over time to have a narrower ripening window and have like separate populations that are early or late or whatever.
So tell me more.
It's a big project with trees.
So tell me more about the species you're working with. Chestnut is obviously a big one. So do you want to tell me a bit more about that? Like, you mentioned mostly Chinese genetics, but is there other species that are being brought into the mix there?
Yeah. So chestnut, I'll just say, is like sort of a collaborative thing, right? Like I'm working with a team of six people and we're collaborating with a nursery and they're sourcing genetics from orchards all over the country that have been sourcing genetics from far and wide. And it's kind of a multi-hundred year effort that I'm just like jumping in and playing a little role in. But yeah, we mostly plant Chinese chestnuts. That's just what does well here. But hybrids do play a role. A lot of the hybrids that we're planting, you might say, are like backcrossed. You know, they're primarily Chinese genetics. If you go back far enough, there'll be some other stuff. Oftentimes we don't even know. It's kind of like cryptic hybridization at this point. They're starting to do some genetic analysis on some of the more common chestnut cultivars, and there's definitely a lot of mixing. For instance, one of the cultivars that's really commonly planted nowadays is called Qing, and everybody thought that was pure Chinese for the longest time. And Now, it seems pretty likely that it has some Castanea pumila in it, which is the American chinkapin.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, there's like weird traits that come through in Ching because of that. It's like very heavy bearing. The nuts are much darker. They tend to be sweet right off the tree. It's a smaller tree.
I'm very
And
curious
so
about
there's.
what the chinkapins bring to breeding projects. They seem like such a strange and mysterious end of the chestnut family.
Yeah, it's true. They are. And it seems like some of the more productive cultivars have some chinkapin in them. Apparently, according to Dr. Sandy, who was a longtime researcher on chestnuts at the Connecticut Agricultural Research Station here, the chinkapins confer a certain amount of resistance to the chestnut gall wasp, which is an increasing problem. So yeah, you never know what you're going to find in all the species of chestnut. There's like 5 to 10 species, depending on who you ask, and they all mix up and do weird stuff. So
now, I remember reading that Luther Burbank really wanted to cross is it Castanopsis? There's a Californian kind of sister genus, and he never got around to do it in his lifetime. Do you think there might be potential for intergeneric crossing with chestnuts?
Yeah, I mean, I dream about it all the time. It's for me, it's kind of like, you know, just what I have the time for, and you know, where the highest return on investment is. Like, there's so much genetic diversity in Castanea already.
Yeah.
And there's so much hybridization work that's already been done. Like the initial crosses have already been made, so it's easier to bring that into your population. But I have thought about, you know, you've got me thinking about intergeneric crosses and mentor grafting and all that stuff. And, you know, there's who knows what you could do if you tried enough times to cross like oaks and chestnuts, or like you said, Castanopsis.
The tricky
And
part
who knows what that would throw.
With big wind pollinated plants like that, the logistics of like controlling the pollination is really irritating. So hopefully putting this idea out there, somebody who's planting a chestnut grove and is in the right climate and can get the material might drop one Castanopsis in the middle of all the castaneers and just see if it sets anything, if it manages to pick up the diverse pollen and starts that, you know, wild card process.
Yeah, that would be really cool. Unfortunately, I don't think any tree that's doing well in wherever Castanopsis grows, like coastal or Intermountain California or something, I don't think it would do well in upstate New York. So.
Yeah. You have to be in just the right part of the world where the two participants in the hybridization do well. So yeah, if that's you, listeners, then do it. Go and plant them and see what happens. What are the goals that you're pursuing specifically with the chestnut breeding, with the project that you're in?
Yeah, I'd say the two biggest things are just disease resistance and like overall ability to withstand environmental stress, and then consistent annual bearing.
Mm-hmm.
Just as a commercial project, that's just really important. And so
are there any pest implications with annual bearing versus biennial bearing? Like, trees do masting for an ecological reason. And is there a danger in like having huge stands that produce every year that, you know, you'll end up with a massive pest or squirrel population?
I think that is a really good point. And I've heard that same thing expressed by some apple growers I know, that biennialism can help to break up pest cycles. I mean, for us in our context, we will hopefully just be breaking up those pest cycles by harvesting everything immediately. Chestnuts do tend to be relatively annual compared to, say, oaks or other masting species. And you will notice if you go to like an abandoned chestnut orchard that everything that falls on the ground is infested with weevils. And it's really disappointing when you harvest a whole lot. And, you know, I did that a lot when I was just getting into this stuff. I would find these spots and I would go harvest a ton of nuts, and then I'd leave them for a couple of days and there'd just be worms everywhere and the nuts would be ruined. Yeah, I think that it's just worth noting that like we're trying to kind of domesticate these trees. And so if you remove that human element and you remove that the harvesting, then it's likely the trees won't be as successful as trees that are following their non-human mediated patterns.
How does the selection strategy and implementation work? Because with large, slow-growing plants like that in a diverse population, like are you culling individuals in mixed stands? How narrowly do you select seeds from the best trees to make the next stands? Like how does that all work?
Yeah, it kind of depends what point you're at in the process. So for our orchards, we're planting select seed from trees that have already been through multiple generations of breeding by other growers. So we're planting about three times as many trees as we want at maturity. So they're 40-foot alleyways, and then in the row we have the trees 13 feet apart. So it's like 80 trees per acre. We'll cut out two out of every three of those, or they'll just die over time. And we'll end up with trees kind of roughly 40 feet apart. And that'll happen pretty quick. The trees grow really fast. I was just harvesting from some 8-year-old trees that are 20 feet tall. But the mother trees that we're getting our seed from are coming from, in some cases, orchards that were planted much more densely than that, with much more diverse germplasm. And then that was winnowed down really aggressively. So one of the orchards we get seed from is called Wintergreen Tree Farm. And the grower there, his name is Bob Staley. And I've only met him once. He probably doesn't know this, but he's kind of a hero of mine. And some decades ago, he sourced chestnuts from every single place he could find them. I want to say he planted like somewhere between 4,000 and 4,500 trees on like, I think it was 400 trees to the acre he was planting. They're like 10 by 10 spacing. And he winnowed those down over the years to 400 trees. So he cut down one, 9 out of 10 trees. And then from those selections, he chose his like the best 60 or so to actually propagate seed from. So it was 60 of the very best trees pollinated by 400 that had gotten through the culling process, and then planted out his next orchard and did the whole thing again. And he was also unique among chestnut growers. He was doing progeny testing like people do for livestock.
How inheritable are the traits? If you have one really great tree, but it produces terrible seedlings, that would be okay for grafting and just cloning, but you don't want to put it into a seed-based population.
Yeah, exactly. So he, from that first orchard he planted, when he took seed for the next orchard, he was actually tracking the parentage. And then when he was evaluating the second orchard, he could say which mother trees produce the highest percentage of good seedlings according to whatever his selection criteria was. So when we were planting our orchards, at least our most recent orchards, once we kind of learned about this whole process he went through and we decided we wanted to get some of his material, we planted a mix of select like in seedlings from particular mother trees from his original planting that progeny tested really well, as well as select seedlings from particular mother trees from that orchard that maybe didn't progeny test as well, but they occasionally threw like crazy trees that were ridiculously productive. So they're kind of like wild cards. And then we also sourced from a population of 60 of the best trees from the second generation. And then we kind of like, we've laid that all out in our orchards so we can track all that. So we can kind of continue on with this progeny testing. But we have a mix of stuff that is pretty reliable and we know it will make good trees, maybe not the most amazing trees. We have stuff that's kind of wild card that will make a lot of duds, but will also hopefully make some incredible things. And then we also have stuff from the most recent generation, which we don't really know exactly what it's going to do.
That's so exciting. I'm still hung up on what are the logistics of selecting trees from a mixed population. Is it most like, when do you make the decision to cull? Do you accumulate multiple years of data, or do you just like look at one season? And like, that's the easier way to do it, of just walk down the stands and pick out the one. But I'm about to do this with a whole range of seed grown persimmons. And I'm like, should I like put ribbons on the ones that are good 1 year, and then like the ones that accumulate multiple good ribbons? Like, how do you actually deal with that? Or do you just have to like make decisions and assume that it won't always be perfect?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is definitely how it's going to go. It's not always going to be perfect. This is something I'm still grappling with, because our oldest trees are only 5 years old. Probably in the next couple of years, we'll have to make some thinning decisions in that older orchard. And so I'm trying to figure this all out right now so I can start to make observations right now. And it's hard, because everybody you've talked to who's done this before kind of has a different opinion. Bob has started to use GPS and is being a little bit more like quantitative in some ways, but he was using this like spray paint marking system for a long time. I don't totally understand it, but he was kind of marking trees with this very simple system to denote like how productive a tree was year to year and how large the nuts were. And yeah, I believe what he was doing to evaluate at least like crop load year to year was pretty qualitative and intuitive. So he would like walk the whole orchard before harvest to get a general sense of what is the median of productivity. And then he would go and mark trees that he kind of like qualitatively considered to be in the top 25% of yield, just based on like how many burrs are in the tree.
Yeah.
Which isn't exact, because sometimes you have really big burrs on a tree that has tiny nuts in it, and so it doesn't correlate to yield. Or sometimes you have unfilled burrs because of pollination, whatever. But I think roughly it worked well enough. And he would do that 3 years in a row. I don't know exactly what year he would start, but he would evaluate for 3 years and then
decide.
Then decide based on, I think it was like, if a tree was not in.
I think I've lost your audio.
I got a phone call.
Oh, that's all right. That's right. I'll edit this out.
I'm ignoring it. Yeah, he would call. He would call any trees that were not in the top 25% of top performers for 2 out of 3 years. If Bob ends up hearing this podcast and everything I'm saying is totally wrong, I'm sorry. I've kind of heard this secondhand from other people.
I think the takeaway lesson is that there is no tried and true perfect one way of doing this. I think everyone, if you're going down this path, you need to get to know your trees and decide what is valuable for you and how to accumulate that information and make the decision at the right time for you.
Yeah, I think the old saying about like farmers' footsteps being the best fertilizer is even more true for plant breeding. And you just have to like always be looking at plants. When I spend a lot of time just like mowing the orchards and just whatever, being out there mulching, doing all the various tasks. And even at this early stage, I'm constantly looking for trees that kind of catch my eye. Maybe they have a weird leaf shape that might denote some kind of hybrid ancestry, or maybe they're just growing really fast right now. And I'm kind of always taking note of those trees, and I have a mental map already of trees that interest me, and a lot of them might be duds, but you might end up in a situation where you have to choose between culling one tree or another, and maybe one is performing a little bit better, but that other one like has been catching your eye for a long time for some reason you can't totally place. And there might be something valuable there. And so just like being able to slow down for a second because you've had your eye on that tree for a long time, it might allow you to kind of catch something that you wouldn't otherwise if you were taking like more of an objective approach.
Well, you can have an approach to selection that's too narrowly data driven. I really think about Luther Burbank breeding for precociousness in chestnuts, and he had trees that were flowering and producing burrs, I think like 6 months after they germinated. And on the surface, you'd be like, that's amazing. I'm going to have this like instant. But the consequence of that is that they never get more than like a foot tall because they're putting all of their energy into producing like three nuts, and they never build up a frame.
I think selecting too strongly for any one trait it's not usually going to end well, and that's kind of factors into my whole philosophy around population breeding. You know, every additional trait that you're selecting for, it makes it harder to actually push any of one of those traits to their limit. But when you're working with a large population, you can have different trees that excel or just different plants that excel in different ways. And, you know, you can even start to like structure the population in different ways. So you might have your really heavy bearing chestnut trees that are good for flower, but they don't really taste very good fresh. And then you have your trees that taste really good fresh, but they're half as high yielding, you know? So
are you working with any other species?
Yeah, I mean, I have a million little projects, most of which are kind of neglected in the garden. But I have, I guess my big personal pet project is trying to do the same thing that Bob Staley did with chestnuts and do it with apples. And so I have like an acre and a half on bread tree land that I've planted out as a seed orchard. And because I haven't really found any like seed sources that appeal to me super strongly, I'm actually starting with a mostly grafted orchard. So I have at this point, I think 75 unique grafted trees planted. And this was all planted this spring. And then, sorry, I think you lost me again. Yeah, 75 grafted trees and 120 seedlings. And the idea there is that once those are mature and producing fruit, I will have kind of a selected pollen cloud so I can take seedlings derived from those trees and plant out a seedling trial somewhere. And I won't be doing any hand pollinating, but I'll know that they have good parentage.
Do you suspect that in the future there will be an opportunity for selling diverse, high-quality seed to people who are interested in going down this path? Because like you were saying, you couldn't find an apple seed population that suited your tastes and your standards. I suspect that might be a future opportunity, though the logistics and the economics of like processing tons of apples and pulping out the seeds, maybe that's not something that can scale very easily.
Yeah, I don't know that there's a lot of money in it, but it's certainly something I want to do if people are willing to plant the trees. Yeah, I mean, part of the reason that I'm doing this project is I came from I worked in commercial apple production for a while, and I saw all the problems in that. It's just so dependent on all sorts of nasty sprays. And you know, I was just asking all these questions about how it could be better. And the thing I kept coming back to is that we're planting clonal trees, and there are better options of disease resistant clones, but eventually the environment, pathogens, pests are going to catch up. And when you have an entire orchard planted to three different clones or whatever, it's just not going to end well. And so I have this wacky idea that apples could be treated in the same way that chestnuts are being treated right now by the growing chestnut industry, and you could have seedling populations. I think it would take a lot to convince most orchardists to actually do that, but I'm kind of going for it anyway. And at the very least, you know, maybe I can produce some clones that people want to plant.
That probably leads into my favorite question in this section. If you could wave a magic wand and like create a new crop, anything, like regardless of how long it's going to take in practice, what would you like wish into existence?
I just started growing flint corn for the first time this year, and I'm kind of obsessed with it. It's so beautiful, but it's also just such an amazing staple crop. Like you take it off the plant and it's dried down and ready to store, and you just hang it up somewhere and take it off the cob when you need it. And it's easy to process at home. And I imagine having chestnuts that are like dry right off the tree and just ready to be stored away and be used in the same way that you might use flint corn, just making polenta or whatever it is. And that's not too far off from where chestnuts are now and have been for a long time. Chestnuts were, as far as I understand it, the original polenta in Italy. But there's an entire process behind that where you have to smoke the chestnuts and dry them down. You know, I look at the way that chinkapins bear their nuts, and I even imagine like a cob of chestnuts coming off of a tree, you know?
Well, you look at where maize came from. Like you look at teosinte, like a completely unremarkable, not very edible wild grass. Like there's probably hundreds of other wild grasses that are more edible than teosinte. And it just with patience and observation and looking for that odd plant in the teosinte crop that was something different, we ended up with something just so radically different and so much more compatible with human society. It might take, you know, another 10,000 years, but there's no reason not to hope that chestnuts could transform to a similar extent. So yeah, I love that answer.
the maize example is really just my favorite, and I love to show people the side-by-side comparison of teosinte and modern maize, and kind of pose the question, like, are any of our other crops really domesticated like this is? Like, especially tree crops. You know, I think about apples as basically being like all of the traits that we think of as traits of domestication in apple. I don't think humans had anything to do with that. I think it was megafaunal selection that selected for large fruit. And then we just picked it up later on and started clonally propagating it.
There's a lot of other crops that we basically inherited from megafauna that were cultivating the for you know, millions of years leading up to that point.
It makes you wonder what we could do if we put our minds to it.
Now, what about the low input side of production? What are your thoughts on that front? Because tree crops are probably one of the ideals for going down this approach.
Yeah. I mean, my whole philosophy of growing is definitely centered around using low to no inputs. That sometimes has to be compromised in a commercial context in the world we live in today. But generally speaking, as far as bread tree is concerned, we use very little input. We don't put any MPK on the trees other than some of our fields that have been manured incessantly by dairy farmers over the past couple decades. But yeah, we are sort of experimenting with kind of remineralization approaches, trying to put down some micronutrients. Chestnuts they have a particular need for boron, which you need very, very little of it, and it's very easy to add too much and for it to be phytotoxic. But boron is soluble and it leaches out of soils that in areas with lots of rain like ours. So that's like a little tiny thing that makes a big difference. I would love to select for trees that don't need boron or don't need as much or are better able to scavenge for it. And I think regardless, like we're kind of going to be doing that anyway, because I'm sure we'll never be perfect in our fertilizing efforts. But
is a major input for tree crops the labor and the tools for like managing the growth? Is that something
absolutely.
That you can breed around? Or even the harvesting, like chestnuts drop their crop, so at least you just have to pick it up off the ground. You're not necessarily up on ladders like you are with apple trees.
Yeah, that's true. But also, if in our case, we are just kind of developing our orchards as a silvopasture system, so there's a grassy or herbaceous understory underneath. It's not just bare soil. So that means mowing, or, you know, if regulations were a little bit different and you were really on top of it, you could graze the perfect amount of time before you needed to harvest. But in our case, we use a significant amount of fossil fuels to be mowing before harvest. And currently we're hand harvesting, but at some point we're going to be investing in some mechanization. And then, there's pruning. Chestnuts we've talked about this before, Shane. Like, trees don't need to be pruned, but chestnuts are not generally pruned with nearly the same intensity that people prune apple trees. But I imagine that we will be doing some amount of pruning, like removing some large limbs here and there. It'll mostly be using chainsaws, and we'll have to thin trees, we'll have to cull trees. So that's running chainsaws. That's not exactly zero input.
Are there other ways of culling partially grown trees? Like, can you use small bonfires selectively to take the culls out? Like, I'm curious. Or just cutting them down when they're close to selected trees that are still fully canopied over is enough to kind of disadvantage them, that they never have a chance to come back.
Yeah, I mean, I just got a photo sent to me by a coworker who is visiting some orchards out in Ohio right now. And he had taken a picture of one of the mother trees that we really like. And it's this big, beautiful tree. And then right next to it is a stump with a bunch of sprouts coming out of it. And I was asking him, what's the deal with that? And he asked the orchardist there, and that was an old tree that they had culled, and then they just planted right next to it. And the older chestnut, after all these years, is still resprouting in the shade, and they just cut it back every year, and the stump doesn't decompose because it's rot resistant wood.
See, in an integrated system, those low level shoots could be browse for the right species.
Absolutely.
They could also be firewood if you're cutting like coppicewood. They're not necessarily something that has to be eliminated. They could be a resource.
Yeah, to me it's totally an advantage. Yeah. I think there's a lot of kind of creative ways that you can use the resprouting of culled trees to your advantage. In terms, like, in just thinking about your comment about bonfires under trees, that is how indigenous people in my region were managing forests to some degree. I think that's like their agriculture. Growing maize, they would kill trees by girdling them or having fires directly at their base. And you would have standing trees, and they would be dropping their limbs over time, which could be harvested as firewood. But then they would just plant their crops among those standing dead trees. And I would love to experiment with some of that kind of thing in our orchard, doing that kind of like milpa style, not really alley cropping, but like just
kind of
killing trees and then
Could you imagine
directly under dead trees?
Could you imagine breeding chestnuts that are more susceptible to dying when they're ringbarked, when you girdle them? Like, that would be a positive trait. But the difficulty is, once you've girdled them and they've proven that trait, they're on their way out. So you'd need to do progeny testing of those lines. But I'd imagine it's one of these things to add onto the wish list.
Yeah. I mean, I think, I don't even know if you would want them to totally die, because you can kind of manage the resprouts to your advantage, either like have a new tree come up, or those small diameter shoots are easier to manage by hand. You don't necessarily need steel tools. You can just snap them off or something. And Yeah, I mean, I'm very interested in syntropic systems, which I don't, it's probably too much to try and define that right now, but
yeah, I'm hoping to talk to some syntropic people in the future. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, but just managing plants as biomass plants and using culled trees in that way. I think that could be super interesting. And I think you could do that without steel tools. It would just, you'd be limited in certain ways, like with bigger trees or bigger limbs, like it would involve girdling or ring barking. And you wouldn't necessarily be able to like chop everything up into pieces and organize the biomass like you see syntropic practitioners doing.
Yeah.
And then you would do more intensive management of smaller shoots just by hand or with whatever simple tools you have.
We should move on to talking about the social networking side of crop breeding, low input, all this kind of stuff. Probably just briefly, tell me about how the bread tree network functions or how it came together. I'm really curious about that backstory because it sounds like it's achieved critical mass and local intensity.
Yeah. So I've been a full-time employee with Bread Tree for a little over a year now. But prior to that, Bread Tree was a lot smaller. It's grown a lot over the past couple of years. And yeah, so prior to being a full-time employee, I had been showing up for like 3 years to help with plantings as part of a larger community that was coming out to do that. It was started by Russell Wallach, and he started on I think it was an 8-acre lease to start, eventually expanded to 20 acres. So he just found a farmer that was interested in this crazy idea, and he put together a revenue sharing lease. So it cost no money up front, and he would only start paying once the chestnuts were producing, and it was a certain percentage of the revenue from the chestnut crop. So it kind of allowed him to get started on a shoestring budget. And he was planting trees with friends and family and started a newsletter. And I was just a nerd, and I was on a USDA website about agroforestry, and I saw a webinar that he had done about land access. And I thought he seemed like a smart guy, and I was interested in chestnuts, and he was working not too far away from me. So I went on the website and I signed up for the newsletter, and a couple months later ended up going to a planting that he was writing about in that newsletter. And I show up there and there's like 15 people all planting trees, and everybody was really cool and fun. And I just had a great time, and I kept coming back, and I started into this pattern where, you know, I'd be working my normal farm job 5 days a week. And then every spring and fall, I would also spend my weekends driving 2.5 hours to go plant trees with these people that I was becoming friends with. And I would just like burn out, but it was totally worth it. And eventually another business partner came in whose name is Noah, and he had some resources to be able to actually buy some land for Bread Tree to plant. And so that was like the first 60 acres that got planted that was actually owned by Bread Tree. And yeah, that part of the reason that's possible is because land is just really, really cheap where I am in upstate New York. And this was a piece of land that was like an abandoned gravel mine and was on the market forever. But chestnuts grow well in gravel. And yeah, so that was kind of the next phase of growth. And then eventually they went around and found some like investors to raise some money and kind of buy a home farm. Hire some people full time, including myself. And now we are on our way to having 250 acres planted. That should be done next spring. We planted 4,000 trees last spring, all planted by hand. But there's still this kind of extended community.
Yeah. I'm definitely going to have to come back in the future and talk to other people in that organization, because it sounds like a model that has hit its stride and could be applied in other places. I want to do a similar thing in my local community with bunyanuts. There's no reason we couldn't be planting thousands of bunyanuts all around the villages in this part of the world, and doing it with really interesting genetics, not just the same old park trees that are all fairly inbred. So yeah, I've got a lot to learn there. There's another side of social networking I wanted to bounce some ideas around about, because we've been friends for a while now, and I did a little social experiment starting a Discord group with the aim of keeping it small. So when I set this group up, I arbitrarily decided no more than 12 people in this group as a countermeasure to so many other social media groups where there's thousands of people in there and you end up basically just screaming into the void and occasionally picking up some piece of information that might be useful to you. But it becomes very non-communal and very inefficient way of finding and distributing information. So yeah, I wanted to get your feedback on how our little tiny walled garden Discord group has worked for you or not worked.
Yeah. I've been really loving that Discord group. I was saying to you before we started recording that it's kind of the only online group that I've felt consistently involved in over a stretch of time. Yeah, I totally experienced that feeling of alienation in other larger groups. And I think I don't know if you said, but it's worth noting like how small this group is. I think it's less than 10 people right now.
I like capped eight. It at 12, and there's a few in there that aren't as active. So I might at some point, if I find someone else to invite in, I might ask someone else if they're okay with leaving because they're not really using it.
Yeah. When people talk about like the ideal community size, I forget what the name of it is, but there's
Dunbar's number.
It's like 150 people in a community, and like beyond that you can't really remember people's names, and I don't know if that's like pseudoscience or legitimate sociology, but if this was a group with 150 people, it would be ridiculous in the same way that every other internet group is ridiculous. And you capped this group at a really, what a lot of people would consider a really small number. And I think that was a good choice. Mm. And it's not that it's like exclusive. I mean, I think we're such weirdos and it's such a niche subject that I don't even know how many other people would want to be in it, but it's very refreshing. And I keep finding myself coming back to it, and everybody, despite only having 10 people, it doesn't feel like a bubble. Everyone seems to have different opinions.
We're fairly diverse in our approaches to things, so it's funny, it's the only place on the internet where every single message that anyone puts up I want to read, even though there's like other people having other conversations about things that I don't do directly. But even comparing that to my email inbox, there's a higher signal to noise in this tiny Discord group than there is in my own personal email. Like, you get spam and things that you're not really interested in your email all the time. But yeah, I definitely think that 150 Dunbar's number is all the people that one person interacts with on a relatively regular basis. So you can be a member of lots of smaller communities that overlap and intersect and kind of stitch the whole world together, like 12 people at a time. That's kind of my feeling of how we can get around this, just the inhuman scale of digital interaction these days, that we have to push back against that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it switches you from being just like a consumer of information to actually having to participate. Because if you, as one of 10 people, are not participating, it's felt.
Yeah.
And you just like reading other people's conversations, like I find myself, because I'm busy with all sorts of stuff. We're all busy. And I often am reading, I'll just go a long period of time without posting in that Discord group, but I always come back because I don't know. I feel like invested in the group and like, I want it to keep moving forward. Yeah. And I'm just the type of person that I'm just kind of hyper fixated on the things that I'm interested in and sometimes have a hard time interacting with people who aren't hyper fixated on those things. And it's nice to have a little community that kind of gets it. And yeah, I don't know if everybody else in the group is as socially strange as I am, but but it's great for me.
So let's round up for the final questions. So these are the kind of broad perspective things. What is your vision for the future of food in your community?
You know, I like living in a world where not everybody has to dedicate their whole life to farming and subsistence. I like the social complexity that kind of builds off of that and the art that is able to happen and et cetera. But I try not to be apocalyptic, but I do think that like eventually at some point we're going to be in a kind of more low energy future. And so I guess I'm just trying to take this long view of trying to figure out how you can continue to have some kind of abundance in a lower energy future. I'm happy if people prove me wrong, but I don't hold out a lot of hope for renewable energy is like totally taking over fossil fuels. And so I guess, yeah, I just see biology and like really, really tight coevolution with plants and animals as the way to kind of secure that abundance. And so I think I just would like to see farmers and land stewards start to get more excited about breeding and about like just understanding genetics and the genetics that they're stewarding and wanting to do more on-farm breeding. I don't think it's something that can really be outsourced. And I think that is kind of our best hope for being comfortable in whatever wacky future is coming for us.
Well, I mean, in your part of the world, you're picking up the threads of what was probably the most advanced agroforestry system on the planet, you know, 500 years ago until it all got blown up and interrupted. But the plants and the genetics, it's all still there. It just needs the people to start interacting with it and appreciating it again.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's exciting to think about what's possible and reading some of the histories about that kind of stuff or encountering people who have a cultural connection to some of those histories. And you get like the teeniest glimpse into what was happening here. It's really invigorating. And yeah, I think the future of food is bright here, but it's... We got a lot more to get through before we get to it.
So who do you think I should interview next? Other than the people who started the Bread Tree project.
Wow, there's so many people doing such interesting work. I think you would get a real kick out of interviewing my friends Jesse and Eric from Yellowbud Farm, which is the nursery that we source from. Mm-hmm. They're just incredibly smart people and have done so much work collecting incredible germplasm. And it almost makes me feel like a little bit of a fraud to like say that I'm a chestnut breeder. Cause really I'm just like getting the best stuff from them because they've done all this incredible work. And then I just get to look at the trees all day. And they're not just working with chestnuts. They work with pretty much any tree crop you could grow around here. And they've done a lot of work with hybrid hickory. They're kind of pioneering that in an amazing way. I also had this thought recently. Have you ever heard the podcast Tides of History?
No.
It's this guy, Patrick Wyman, and It's one of my favorite, I love history, and it's one of my favorite history podcasts because it's a nice combination of narrative and also like going into some of the latest science. And he focuses at least 50% of the time on just regular people and, you know, talking about peasants and what their day-to-day life was, which is kind of rare, I think,
that is
in the way
right
that people approach history.
That is right up my alley. I do want to bring in guests who are like bird's eye view, big picture thinkers about the past and the future. So yeah, that's definitely on my list.
And he's an author, and his like he's not just like some random podcaster. Like he's got some credentials, and I think that would be a really interesting conversation because you would probably also blow his mind on some of this domestication stuff. And yeah, I think that would be really cool. I think that's a big blind spot where people just don't, I mean, I don't understand how people lived in the past, just regular people day to day, and how dependent we have been on these plants and like, the way that just the contingencies of history and weather alter those interactions. And I think understanding that stuff is going to be very important for us all going forward. So yeah, Patrick Wyman, Tides of History.
I'm gonna get right on to that and listen to all of the back episodes. That sounds exactly like my kind of thing. And it's a bit of a problem at the moment. Podcasts have very poor discoverability. Like if you try to Google for podcasts on a particular topic, it doesn't seem to work.
Yeah.
So yeah, you rely on recommendations like that to find the best stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he does it through Wondery. Have you ever heard of it? It's like a bunch of podcasts,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, you get ads and it's like a well-produced kind of fancy podcast, I guess. But you're right. Even so, I don't know how I found that in the first place. I was probably Googling some very niche topic popped up.
So how can people learn more about your work or possibly get in touch?
So Breadtree, you can learn more about us at our website, which is just breadtreefarms.com. We're also on Instagram. And then all my personal stuff is generally under the name Quivering Twig. And so I'm on Instagram, Quivering_Twig. I have a Substack with two posts from a long time ago and I haven't added anything else, but that's quiveringtwig.substack.com. And I think that's about it.
That's enough for people to learn more. So what is your final message for people thinking of getting into local agriculture?
I think I would just say fake it till you make it, because that's absolutely what I did. I had a couple very encouraging peers and mentors when I just was getting into all of this. And my one good friend, Matt Kaminsky, who's an incredible orchardist in this region. I remember he wrote a blog post a number of years ago that was basically imploring people to just like, if you work with apple trees, call yourself an orchardist. You don't have to own land. You don't have to like even have trees that are your own that you're tending. Like if you have any relationship with apple trees or tree crops in general, just start calling yourself an orchardist and like claim that for yourself. And that was really pivotal for me. I think really identifying yourself with the work, even if you feel clueless, can really help you on your path. And it in an odd way, it sort of opens doors. You know, you want to be humble, but I think just lean into it if you're really excited about it. And it'll kind of work out.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me and the audience, and yeah, clue us in on all the amazing new pathways that are opening up for people as this side of agriculture is growing all around the world. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Shane.
The Zero Input Agriculture podcast is a solo passion project built with my ample time and meager resources. If you would like to support the show, then sign up for a paid subscription to my Zero Input Agriculture blog at Substack. As a reward, you can read all my past posts and listen to the audiobook of Taming the Apocalypse. If you prefer reading about the past and future of biological technology, you can read the ebook of Taming the Apocalypse through Amazon. And finally, please rate and review the show on whatever podcast app you use, since it helps other people find me, or recommend the show directly to anyone who could use some inspiration to become a plant breeder themselves.